Shoes would be tough too, though.
I like Sue's.
Like, I can see if you were friends, but like strangers being like, "Hey, Sue's, what do you think?" It's some bit in Seinfeld, so maybe that's why it's burnt into my head. It's like, but Susie, I love, and I also. How did you get the Instagram handle? That seems like you would have had to bribe someone. So great.
Funny story. In college.
Here we go.
In college, my friends called me Suzanimal because I went pretty hard. So.
For obvious reasons. Wow. Yeah.
For obvious reasons. So Suzanimal became like my alter ego, but now it's a name that stuck. And I somehow got it on Instagram. I don't know how. Yeah. Someone else didn't have it, but here we are.
Amazing, because yeah, the name, it's like, yeah, I that's a great nickname, but I can see, you know, where that'd come from. But getting the rights,
right,
good stuff. And did you go to school in Hawaii?
I did. I went to school in Hawaii.
Cool.
Yeah. Wow. I'm from Indiana originally, and I wanted to study marine biology, so it was between there and the University of Maine, and I was like, I'm getting the hell out of Dodge, so I'm going to go to Hawaii.
Maine ain't going anywhere.
So yeah, I was there for all 4 years. I actually ended up with a degree in psychology, and I studied marine mammal behavior specifically.
Really?
Oh. Yeah. So like, marine psychology, basically?
Kind of. More of a focus on, like, training and behavioral aspect.
Yeah.
Fucking
if you do
amazing.
Take that super meta, you could be the person who trains the people who then trains the marine mammals. And that would be all the way full circle.
All the way.
I'm in the mood to be slow and careful. My body's ready for a mountain climb. All of a sudden, the flower that opens in the morning light.
That'd be something. Let's
very
keep it
niche.
Tangible, though. This we have Susie Hayes, global director, which is an awesome thing. That I hope that you have a placard somewhere that says that of the three row 34 restaurants.
That's me.
Thank you for taking the time to come sit down and talk to us. I'm not going to derail this too early, but as somebody who grew up in Southern New Hampshire, has a lot of friends in Boston, incredible to see what Row 34 has done. But even before that, you were telling a story here a minute ago about your college days. In my college days, I was a very sad boy.
Aww.
So I fell in love with a bar in Boston called Bukowski. And read some of the books, fell in love with the man, and then I went down there. And I'm not making this up. I think I went down, it would have probably been 2019. Me and my friend had a beer, had some hot dogs, which tend to be able to find on that menu quite often.
Mm-hmm.
And the woman behind the bar was singing the praises of a Susie. I think it was right before... I swear to God, I'm not making this up. I think it was right before Extreme Beer Fest.
Yeah.
Would have been in Boston. So she was talking about you need to check out Row 34. You got to see this draft list they have, this world-class draft list, talking about some of the breweries that were coming in for Extreme Beer Fest. And now I sit here 2 years later in a chair talking to you virtually, but I texted my best friend last night to, I have a tendency to get excited, but to like make sure I wasn't making this up. I was like, you remember when we went to Bukowski? He's like, yeah. I was like, do you remember the bartender talking about Row 34 and this girl named Susie's like, I mean, I don't specifically remember anybody's name, but she was raving about Row 34 and who curated their draft list.
Oh, I love that.
So welcome to the program. And apparently it is well documented. What a good job you do.
Oh, thank you.
Like many places to begin. It'd kind of be interesting. I can't help but ask a little bit about the P.F. Chang's origin. Mm-hmm. I've actually never been to a P.F. Chang's. They're not a main thing, are they? I don't believe
not that
anyway.
I've ever seen up here.
How fast of casual is it?
Very.
Like, okay, so like you stand, you don't even sit down?
No, you sit down, but I mean, as far as like the formalities of it all, it's very chain. It's very Midwest.
Okay.
It's very TGI Fridays without like the flair, of course, but.
Of course.
Yeah. Trademark. You know, there's, you can only have so much flair, and I didn't have any flair, so. But I was I got that job, and I was in high school, and my dad like drove by and he was like, oh, they need a host, you should just work there. And I was like, yeah, I'll work there, it's down the street. And so for your first job, it wasn't too shabby. I actually really enjoyed it.
Absolutely.
Totally.
And if you're football fans, Peyton Manning used to be a regular at that P.F. Chang's. And
oh, really?
As was Tony Dungy. And then Marvin Harrison would come in for takeout from time to time. So,
damn. I can see Tony Dungy at a P.F. Chang's. I was going to say,
I'm a Tony Dungy fan out of those three. I'll take Dungy any day.
But I mostly asked just – you mentioned in the other podcast I listened to with you on it, just that you had always loved to work. And I was just having the conversation the other day with, Seth, like our first employee. Mm-hmm. And I don't know how we got there, but we ended up talking about like our first jobs, like, okay, you have a formal paycheck that comes like from in the mail and there's taxes deducted, yada, yada. And how we both were like, it wasn't a laziness thing, but there was a certain level of intimidation of like, oh, you'd talk a lot about wanting a job. Then when it came time to actually go in and look someone in the face and apply with your resume, it was like got super scary in a hurry. I might be taking a jump, but just from the tone of how you talked about P.F. Chang's, it didn't seem like you had that intimidation. It seemed like you were excited from the jump.
Yeah, it was a new opportunity for me, and I'm an Army brat. My dad's a retired full-guard colonel, so I think that there's always been this sort of work ethic within me, and I love having a job. I love having a schedule. I love this sort of like routine. Not to say that I enjoy things to be like repetitive by any means, but there's just something about like being proud of your job. And was I going to work at P.F. Chang's forever? No way. But I really loved it. It was a new skill. I was on the host stand. I met new friends. Like, it was fun. And I made money, and I was able to buy things for myself, and it felt really good. And I loved...
Yeah.
I love working. I don't know.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I don't mean to... And I've talked about P.F. Chang's so fucking much, and I'm dropping it right now. Yeah, I was just... Pete and... I don't know. Most of the hardest working people I know have their roots in restaurants. Matt's one of them. Yeah. I won't classify myself, but just a lot of people that are in restaurants for a long time, especially when they kind of maybe take some sort of like slight lane change to sort of playing the same game in a different arena. I find it like sometimes it's like explosive to watch, I think is kind of what I'm getting at. And obviously, like I barely know you, to be frank, but just from the almost persona you have, you've created through your work. You haven't created it by like anything beyond that. And I just find how like known of a figure really, in respect to the figure you are in a city that in Maine seems gargantuan. Yeah, so just sort of starting with the roots on that. P.F. Chang's out.
I think it's true. I think that a lot of people who have roots in this industry, they're cut from a different cloth, you know? And I think that it's so important for people to be involved in the industry in some way, because it really teaches you a lot about not only hard work and routine, but it teaches you about like respecting your team, being a team player, and then also respecting guests and like what that means and what extending a welcoming hand really means. And I don't, you know, we won't get into customers always right or anything like that, but I think it does teach you some really important life skills. And when you're 16, when I started, that's like, those are really important life skills that even if you don't carry them through your entire life and you're not in a restaurant your entire life, you at least like begin to understand what that type of work really is like and what that means.
Totally. I found them to be incredibly transferable skills, like the ability to be calm under pressure,
totally.
The ability to make somebody else happy or de-escalate somebody when they're not happy,
yes.
Kind of all the things that happen in the fast-paced environment
totally.
Of restaurants, found to be incredibly transferable.
Yeah, absolutely.
But it wasn't always going to be restaurants, was it?
It wasn't, no.
You went to school for marine biology?
I did.
Right down the road?
Down the road.
I'm not going to live there forever, but I do, I got to know, from what we've heard, it's almost as if you became allergic to your job and your profession. Is that correct?
There it is. That is correct. That's, yes.
That's the joke he was waiting on.
I think my job is done here.
Your job's done. That's it. That's it.
Yeah. But so you kind of end up, did you, not to, again, like, put too many words on you, but did you kind of end up in a place where you were forced to look at what you were going to do with your life? Like, what I've dedicated time to and kind of invested in isn't going to be able to be it for me. What am I going to do now? Did you have kind of one of those moments?
I did, and it was really strange because it wasn't like overnight, like all of a sudden. It was a progression. So after I graduated college, I moved back to Boston. I had done an internship at the New England Aquarium while in college. Came back, finished, graduated, and I loved it. I loved Boston so much that I was like, I can go to the aquarium, I can volunteer there. There's a PF Chang's there, I'll work there. I'll work a restaurant job in the meantime, and then hopefully I'll earn my way into getting a job at the aquarium, and that will sort of get me into where I need to be. Because especially when it comes to zoos and aquariums, these jobs are very highly sought after, so you really kind of have to pay your dues before you can get in. So while that was happening, I developed a skin allergy. So like tactile, whenever I would handle the fish or squid to feed the animals, I would develop a rash, which is actually fairly common. So I didn't really think much of it. And then all of a sudden it just kind of escalated into like a food allergy. And then when I was in the kitchen too long, my asthma would start to act up. So over time, it really just became more of like a dangerous situation than it was for me to be able to do what it was that I wanted to do. So it really ultimately came to the decision that I had to leave the aquarium. But at the same time, I had gotten a new job at Row 34, which is a primarily seafood restaurant. I would like to mention that. Like, it's been, I like to live on like this little line of like danger. But like,
you're flying real close to the sun.
Real close. But at the same time, I was lucky enough to have the job that I had, and I had started at this new restaurant and really loved it. So, I think probably a year into me being at Row, I then unfortunately had to quit the aquarium and kind of reassess what it was that I wanted to do. But it was at that same time that I was actually just really super interested in beer. So I was very fortunate in that I had other passions and things that I could think about doing. And so it just kind of organically happened that way. Not to say that I wasn't very sad about leaving the aquarium and not being able to do this thing that like my whole life I had like really wanted to do.
Yeah. What were the moments and the experiences that were getting you into beer and setting you up to be in a place where you'd be applying for Row 34?
So when I was, we're going to talk about PF Chang's so much here, I feel like.
Yeah, let's do it.
When I was bartending at PF Chang's, the owner of Bukowski, whose name is also Susie.
That makes it complicated.
It makes it complicated. So she's now Big Susie and I'm Little Susie.
Gotcha.
I'm 5'1", so Little Susie is appropriate. So she was a regular of mine. She needed a manager. I didn't know anything about beer. She was like, someone can teach you, no problem. I just think that you're great. So do you want to come work at my bar? It's all cash. You bring your money home. And I was like, that sounds pretty great to me. So then when I started working at Bukowski, I really had no idea what it was I was getting myself into. And I had no idea that there were like the world of beer was this vast. I had no clue. Like in my life, I had probably drank like Natty Light, Michelob, and like Bud Light. Like, I didn't really know. And I really started to love it. And I met so many good friends there, and they were very helpful. And they were like, all right, like, this is like what you need to be drinking. Like, taste this. And so my eyes really opened to this world that I had no idea existed. And I was like, this is really freaking awesome. Like, what else is out there? And then so 2 years into Bukowski is when I applied to the job for at Row 34 for a service manager position. And I really didn't feel qualified at the time, but I felt confident in my ability to learn. So I was like, I'm just going to go for it. If I don't get it, no problem. And then I ended up getting it, and I've been at Roe for 7 years now, I think.
That's incredible.
Confidence, I've never, like, it's not that complicated of a thing, but I've never quite been able to put, like, the most concise amount of words together for I really believed in my ability to learn. And, like, that, God damn it, is that so valuable. Like, it is so important, and it's, mm-hmm. like, what employers are constantly looking for, but it is a lot more, you know, than those 4 or 5 words. But I don't know. That just struck me the way you said that, because, like, that's the driver, and, like, that's all the fucking driver ever is. Because when you're, I remember, not to make it about me at all, but I just remember, and I know Matt's felt many of the same things. Like, am I even, what the fuck am I doing here?
Still feel that. Yeah, struggling through that, yeah, right now. Right.
Yep. But yep. Like, moving to Portland, and this isn't a, but I was literally like a bumpkin at this point from like Northern Maine. So Portland was a big step up. And the pig, Pete, kind of had like some sort of like loose in there, right across the street from Navarre, which is like what I always hear about. But I like was too intimidated to even apply there. You know, I'd certainly had nothing of, I had just restaurant experience and was super into beer, but it just wasn't even, it's weird how that wasn't even on my like register. So yeah. Like, what was the shove to actually like kind of, I don't know, where I kind of said, nah, you said, yeah, why not? Yeah. What is that? What's the difference there?
I don't know. I think I knew I needed a change. And I think I felt at the time that I had learned what I could learn. And with Roe, there was opportunity for growth in lots of directions. There was growth within the beer world. There was growth within the restaurant group itself. And mm-hmm. I felt like it would have given me a really great stepping stone into whatever else it was. And again, like I said, at that time, I was really sort of in limbo when it came to the aquarium and unsure of where that was going to go. So I knew that I needed to make some steps forward. And I just felt like it was the time to do something different. And I felt like it was different, but similar enough that I could do it.
And for people listening that aren't as familiar, and yeah. A second part to that question is, where was Roe in terms of their prestige at that time when you applied, whether that was already James Beard nominated or not. But to start, for people listening that aren't familiar or aren't from the East Coast, describe Roe 34 in your words. What encompasses it? What is it?
At the time when I applied, they were only really open for a year. So Roe 34 mm-hmm. was and still is a primarily oyster bar. We serve beer, wine, and then cordials. But the real concept was is that you could go in and you could enjoy this really great, you know, atmosphere in this area that really at the time wasn't super popular in the seaport. There really wasn't much out there. There was less than Trillium, and that was pretty much it. And
the two best places in non-coastal Boston.
And many have come since then.
But the idea of this, like, almost like casual feel, but the experience was high level. It was high touch. Mm-hmm. And the ingredients and the food and the beer were all high quality. I really enjoyed that sort of, you know, mix between the two. And, again, it was a new sort of concept for me. And I was really interested in Megan, who is my predecessor. She had made a name for herself in the beer world. And I was like, what better person to learn from than her? And I went for it.
Just to put my own words on it, is that like fine dining or fine experience without the stuffiness?
I wouldn't call it
fine dining. Or is that taking it too far?
Yeah, I wouldn't call it fine dining. I would just call it elevated experience, but without the sort of pretension behind it.
Mm-hmm. Because the reason I even butt that in is because being that age and not being from Boston or in Boston, I'd come visit a lot and I'd go to these places and I'd have incredible food and I'd have incredible drink, but I really wouldn't enjoy, it felt like out of my league.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? And then as I got into this world, places like a Trillium or places like this are what really kind of opened up all of food and beverage for me to fall in love with it and want to pursue it as a career.
Yeah. We have this saying at the restaurant that we say professionals only. And what it stems from is really the Oyster Bar. And they have this sign on their dock and it says professionals only. And, you know, it's kind of a play. It's, you know, while this atmosphere feels very sort of casual, we're farmers, we're oyster farmers, we're a restaurant in an industrial space. While that feels casual, we do take our producers very seriously. We take our farmers seriously. We take mm-hmm. our program seriously, and we care about them. And, you know, that sort of mindset, I think, is really what envelops Row 34 and the concept itself.
Gotcha.
I'm super curious because you seem very passionate. You and the restaurant group as a whole seem very passionate and just put a lot of value on just training and education across the board, which is more difficult than it seems on paper for sure. So I want to definitely talk about that, especially now with multiple locations and how mm-hmm. that's a whole different ball game, I'd imagine. But I'm kind of curious how you remember yourself being trained and brought in, because you speak almost as an owner in terms of like how passionate and I mean that as the highest compliment.
Yeah.
Highest compliment. In terms of just how genuinely you're talking about how just, you know, your value system and how it relates to the restaurant. So yeah, however you want to talk about it, how do you remember kind of these ideas being shown and instilled upon you?
I found it to be overwhelming. Overwhelming in like the best way possible, but I had not, I mean, coming from a corporate sort of scenario with...
Did you work again?
Little restaurant, you know, P.F. Chang's, here we are. it's very different than this sort of corporate, like, here's, you know, X, Y, and Z. You have to do this. You have a spiel at your table.
Yep.
These are the words that you use. These are the words you don't. Instead, it was so much more than just sort of this robotic, here's a script, follow it. Here's what we do. And we don't do anything outside of that. So, and then there was Bukowski, where it was me bartending, slinging beers, hot dogs, all of that, which was another experience in itself. So to come to this, you know, family that had been around for so long and had really created this like ecosystem of just amazing, super smart people, I felt so overwhelmed. And I was like, wow, like our GM at the time, she knew so much about wine. She was a sommelier, and she just was like, she could talk about wine as if, you know, you would talk about your family. Like, she just knew so much. And it just, like, I'm in over my head. Like, how do I?
Beer it is.
Here we are. And then on top of that is, like, you're having to learn the beer list. And, you know, the beer list is ever-changing. And you have to learn the oysters and the farmers and, you know, why we change sets seasonally and why we work with, you know, Red's Best down the street. And it was eye-opening, honestly. It was overwhelmingly eye-opening. And I was like, I had no idea that you could really, you know, put together this restaurant that's really based around things that you care about. And that mm-hmm. everything here matters. There's a reason why we do this, and this is why. And that blew my mind. And I just remember being really overwhelmed. But at the same time, I was like, wow, this is like on a level that like I had no idea that was even possible. Mm-hmm. I was like, everyone here is so smart. What do I do? Yeah.
Well, and that's kind of also just not to go on a tangent, but just to kick it back that, like you said, transferability of mm-hmm. skills in a restaurant. We're talking almost like in the reverse kind of way of it. But I had a psych degree, and like until basically I started homebrewing, I was like, all right, I guess I'll either be a guidance counselor or like keep going to school forever. And for the same kind of reasons you were talking about, it seemed like in the marine biology kind of world of like, all right, there's like not a lot of these jobs. You have to do a lot to even get them. And even when you get them, I don't know. I can't speak for probably in marine sciences, probably a little bit more money. But even if you get one of these coveted jobs, not a huge payday at the end of that wild brick road. Mm-hmm. So then to almost see the flip side of going into a place like, especially like just the aesthetics and visual of Roe, it must have just felt. And I mean, I know Bukowski's was in between them, but just the service life where people know what the fuck they're doing in general, just the potential of that versus kind of being like, this is gonna, not only is this allergy happening, but like, even if it wasn't, this is still like a long ass road for me to be, you know. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so that wasn't even really a question, but I just wanted to say that. But anyways, to get back to training, because that is what we are here, or one of the things we're here to talk mm-hmm. about. But on that other podcast, I heard you say, I think the figure, like an hour of basically service prep, like an hour long team meeting, basically before every service. Is that true?
It was, obviously with COVID stuff, we're not open as often, and services are a little bit different. So we do our hour-long briefings on Wednesdays and Thursdays, Fridays if we can, but it's usually a little shorter. So we don't spend as much time in-house as we once did. Hopefully that'll all change come 2022 and things feel a little bit better. But yes, we would spend an hour of every day going over the menu, any menu changes, and then the manager on duty would then choose a subject to talk about, and that could really encompass anything. It could be beer related, and that could be so many things. It could be oyster related. It could be fish related. It could be really anything. We would spend that time really talking about that subject and, you know, having a conversation and learning about, you know, what aspect of this is relevant to the restaurant itself or to us as a team as a whole.
Was it more like kind of, I don't want to say quite presentation, but basically I have the floor for this, listen, more or less listen to me talk for, you know, 45 minutes or whatever? Or was it very focused on it being conversational?
It depended, because there was different activities surrounding it. So sometimes we would play like Jeopardy, and it would be restaurant-related Jeopardy. So obviously that's a game, so everyone's involved in talking. It could be a presentation. It could be a PowerPoint. It could be, you know, someone went to a winery and they wanted to talk about their experience there, reading an article, watching a TED talk. So it really depended on that day and what was really sort of the briefing for that day.
Wow.
But I think as we've evolved, I think it's become even more conversational. For me, it's really important to have everyone's opinion and really everyone's sort of thought process into things. So whether that's talking about a beer and then saying, okay, how do we talk about this table side? Who would like this beer? What do we pair it with? Do you like it? Do you not like it? Why do you not like it? And just it becoming more of a conversation than it just me or someone else like just kind of dictating something. It really should be about like the group as a whole in some way, shape, or form.
Yeah, and I just kind of ask about that because I completely agree with you, but it kind of goes in waves, I guess, for me in terms of how actually it can be sometimes very hard to truly get people's opinion out of them, especially if you're kind of in the, you know, managerial sort of role. There's usually a certain filter everyone's speaking through, some percentage of a filter of like what you want to hear. And that can just be, can make the whole thing suck because it's just this shitty echo chamber and everyone knows no one's really saying anything. So do you think that's mostly just kind of a time thing? Because I know like the closer obviously you get with, you know, coworkers, the easier that kind of naturally becomes.
I mean, I think it's a combination too. I think it's a combination of, you know, your team trusting you and trusting that it's a safe space to speak and to have a conversation. But it's also, mm-hmm. you know, you have to earn people's respect as someone that can talk about things candidly or can talk about a subject in a way that is educational. I'm not saying that I'm, you know, that I know of, but like, you know, here we are 7 years later, and I think that we have created a team that's been together for a long time. They trust each other's opinions. They pretty much know each other's opinions at this point as well. So the conversations over time have definitely become more candid, and actually being able to watch that. And, you know, my position has changed over time as well. So watching them grow along with me has become really freaking awesome. So like, not dumb it down, but it's really freaking awesome to be able to have a team where I feel like I can present something to them and they can say, I don't care for it, but I understand why people like it. Or, hey, like, this is really great. Like, let's talk about this more. Or can we talk about this next time? And they know that this is a space that they can have those kinds of conversations. And I would never want them to feel like they can't tell me something good or bad. So over time, I feel like those conversations have developed into these really great sort of educational opportunities for everyone involved, not just them, but me as a leader.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And I find this fascinating because they're, when it comes to like the training and education thing and kind of raising the bar, and I think you used the word elevated experience before talking about it, you need to have this element almost to like your culture, your business model to get to that place. And there is, if you could still have a meeting every day, but if somebody's presenting or talking and the rest of the staff isn't excited to hear this information and then excited to share that information with the people who are going to come through the doors, then that really doesn't matter. Even if you've prioritized the education time, which for some businesses, that's the hard part.
Yeah.
Like we've got to get the dollars to the bottom line. We've got to keep this running.
Time to educate.
We don't have the time, the labor, to do these extra hours. But say you have that part right, and you do prioritize that in the right way. What are the tools to get everybody on board to be excited to learn about this new breed of oyster, or this new oyster farmer, this new beer we're bringing in from this brewery, and this is why we're doing it? How do you get everybody on board excited to hear those things?
I think by having them involved just constantly. And while I don't expect, you know, everyone to be as excited about a new fest beer that we have coming in, I do know that they're still excited to learn about it because I'm excited about it. I'm not bored with it. Mm-hmm. I think it's really freaking great. And if I can give them just even like one little nugget of like information on why it's important or why I feel like it's on the list or why I like it, then if they can take one thing away from that, then to me, I've succeeded in that sort of exchange of information. And yeah. I also think that, you know, we have the type of team that doesn't look at, you know, their job as just, you know, this is a side job. I'm just a server. I'm just a bartender. They're involved.
All professionals.
Professionals only, you know, but they're involved. Our bartenders make their own cordial cocktails. They experiment with syrups. They go to breweries and say, Suze, I've tried this beer. I really like it. Can we have it, or can we get it, or can I talk about it? And it becomes this like, almost like they become passionate about it just in being involved. So while it's tough to teach someone, you know, to work hard, or it's tough, you know, to get someone maybe to be initially excited about one thing, you always know that like, if you can encourage someone to be a part of a group, if you can encourage them to learn, and hey, you may not like everything about it, mm-hmm. but find something that you do like about it. And yeah. Think about it that way. Like, are you excited about hearing about the fishermen that we're working with? Awesome. Are you excited about, you know, our oyster farmers? Great. Are you excited about oysters? Are you excited about, you know, sauces? Like, what are you excited about? Find that niche and learn about it and be passionate about it. And, you know, while you're here, you're going to enjoy all these things. You need to know about them. They're part of the experience, but I'm not asking you to be the next, you know, beer director and next, you know, som. We're not asking those mm-hmm. things of you. I think it's all of those things. You have to take care of your team, or else people aren't going to want to stay. And that's really just it. If you're in a friend group and you feel like you're isolated all the time, you're not going to want to hang out with those people. And, mm-hmm. you know, us being in a restaurant, we're all together almost all the time. And it's this like very complex ecosystem of, you know, we take care of each other via pay, via sick time, time off, vacation, all of those things. But we also take care of them in the way that we invest in the team. And I think that education is a part of investing in them. If someone wants to, say, stage at a brewery, hey, I'm super interested in brewing, awesome. Is there anyone in particular you're excited about? I'm happy to reach out to them for you. We've done those things. And I think investing in them, not just like in the restaurant itself, but in them personally.
Yeah.
If that makes sense. Did that answer your question?
I think these are the kind of the X factor, like special juice things that some people have that are tough to answer in a granular fashion, but they always tend to come down to these same like core good things. You know what I mean? But in terms of what you just said, I've heard you talk about like bringing staff to other places to tour.
Yep.
And then the joy that you kind of get when you watch them share a tidbit or find an excitement point that came from that gets shared so on wonderful. Premise.
Yes.
And that, do you guys do a lot of that in a framework setting in terms of we're going to this brewery or going to this place? Is that a big part of this training and culture building?
It is. Getting outside of the restaurant and exploring is really, you know, a huge part of it. And I'll give you a good example. We went to Kent Falls a couple weeks ago, and Barry is such a wonderful human being. I love him so much. But, you know, I can only talk about Barry so much for them to be like, oh, I don't know this Barry person that you're talking about, but for them.
Jesus, enough about Barry.
But like,
it's all P.F. Chang's and Barry with you people.
What the hell? But for them to like go to Kent Falls and to see the farm and to see the brewery and to hear Barry talk about his experience as a brewer, as, you know, someone that was coming up in Connecticut in a place that was really just kind of like in the middle of nowhere, and to watch them sort of be like, oh my God, this place is awesome. And they've had Kent Falls beers many times over, but to actually like experience, you know, Barry's experience and to see like what that was, it just, That's what it's about. It's about celebrating each other, and it's about celebrating the people that I'm excited about and that we as a team are excited about, we as like an industry are excited about. And for them to get to experience that on like a very visceral level is, to me, like that's what's magic. That's what like gets me excited about doing what I do, is when I get to share it on a level that maybe they wouldn't be able to experience otherwise. So that, of course, is a part of the education, but it's also me saying like, hey, like, look how awesome this is. I love it. Like, you love it.
How has that evolved? And I guess just your role in general, with the first Portsmouth, which was what, 4 years ago?
4, maybe 5.
Okay. And then Burlington, which is quite new, like in the last year.
Yeah, so formerly Island Creek, and then it's transitioned into a row within the past year.
And Island Creek is a concept that's owned by your restaurant group, or the restaurant group that owns Row 34?
We are just Row 34 now.
Okay.
Gotcha.
Okay, so previously, because that was always interested in me, and like I've been reminded a million times that about the Island Creek connection.
Yeah.
But it always struck me as, to me, admirable and cool how that was extremely understated in terms of like the experience of actually going to the restaurant. You know, like they're serving Island Creek oysters, and I'm sure that there's some note of it on the menu I don't really remember, but it's not like the Island Creek Beer House or some, you know what I mean? Like, which is, you know, usually the direction a lot of other versions of that go in.
Yeah.
And it immediately somehow cheapens it out of the gate without intending to.
It becomes gimmicky.
Was that kind of separation talked about like tangibly a lot as an important, intentfully a lot? Or was it just sort of a manifestation of how the people behind everything were as people?
Oh, so I see what you're saying. So
terrible way to say it first.
No, you're I'm in my head and you're in yours, and like I'm picking up what you're putting down.
Hoorah.
We're still connected with the farm. Very much so. We still work with Island Creek. We still work with Skip. We had two Island Creek oyster bars that were a little bit different from the Row 34 concept. Actually, Island Creek Oyster Bar in Kenmore, next to Eastern Standard, was before Row 34 in Four Point. And we were just sort of like a different concept from that, focusing primarily on beer and a little bit more of a casual experience than, you know, what was offered at Island Creek Oyster Bar. And then over time, the partners all kind of got into their own projects. So now our current partners, Skip and Chef Jeremy, they've ventured into just the Row 34 category, and everyone else has ventured into their own things. Skip is really investing in Island Creek, the farm. They have this really awesome bar in Duxbury that operates during the summer. If you haven't been there, you should go and go on a farm tour. It is so epic. It's so fun.
I got bit by the oyster bug this summer after going out a couple times.
Yes. Yeah. It's so cool. And again, like, you're from the Midwest, right?
Me?
Are you?
No, I grew up in Southern New Hampshire.
Southern New Hampshire, okay. But like for
might
me...
Might as well be.
But for me, like growing up in the Midwest, like I didn't know what the hell an oyster farm was. I didn't even know that was a thing. And then out here, I'm like, wow, that is like pretty freaking cool. So...
The crazy thing is, like, we were talking about it last week. We had
oyster farmer on last week.
A man who literally is called Oyster Guy.
That's his name.
And I kind of knew a little bit about it, but how huge it has even exploded. Like, it's always, well, for the, certainly as long as I've been alive, oysters have existed. But in
you
terms
can eat
of,
them.
Like, how just part of the normal lexicon and, like, hey, want to grab oysters? They become in the last even 5 years.
Yeah. It parallels craft beer and its explosive growth over the last like 5 to 10.
And enter Row 34. Look at that. So getting back to Portsmouth though,
yes.
In terms of just how we were talking a little bit about it before, but just the kind of wrench, it's a good wrench, but it makes things a lot more difficult than they used to be with Milo. And now with Portsmouth, and then adding a third restaurant with Burlington, just kind of explain just sort of, yeah, the what changed for you for better or worse with those, with that growth?
Like for me personally, like in my
position. Yeah, you personally, in or out of work really, but I would, you know, there'd be definitely some mental gymnastics to continue operating at that same level, but, you know, naturally being having to do it at three places.
Yeah. I mean, right now, again, it's very different. It's not going to be the way it is now forever because everyone's short-staffed. So I'm primarily in Boston right now. For Portsmouth, I'm very lucky in that their bar manager, who's been there for a very long time, Ree, she is very well versed in the New Hampshire beer community, so she has a very good grasp on the ins and outs of that, like, sort of field. So she really curates that list with my guidance, but she is really awesome at her job. So I'm very lucky in that I have her to sort of, you know, be my backbone at that space. In Burlington, I really put together the list and I try to be there right now once a month, maybe twice a month to help educate the staff in person. But I have some materials and with the help of other managers, I'm able to sort of facilitate the educational aspect of it. And then as far as the makeup of the list, I do all of the ordering and all of the sort of design of the menu itself and then just kind of juggle Boston and Burlington at the same time.
Mm-hmm. So, and that's kind of why I chuckled when you said field, because not only are there different going to be a sometimes like wildly different beers available to you in a different state, but the laws around those
different
can
as well.
Be literally a full-time job to navigate, especially in fucking New Hampshire. No offense.
Hey,
especially in
stop
New Hampshire.
It. No, stop hey. It.
My beautiful wife in the other room, also from New Hampshire, beer
Hester,
laws.
Hester, come help.
Fucking terrible, though.
Fucking terrible, no.
They're terrible. We've at least had drops of beer just about everywhere, you know, in New England, but not New Hampshire. Not worth it.
Yeah,
it
hurts my feelings.
They've definitely come a long way. I mean, I remember when we opened that space, they really struggled with finding not just beer, but, you know, wine and spirits as well. Uh-huh. It's just a really tough market to work through, but they've definitely come a long way. There's a lot more that's available now, which is really, really good. I definitely remember it being tough to compete with Kittery being so close, because mm-hmm. they obviously were able to get the things that, you know, everyone in Maine can get, but, you know, just 10 minutes down the road, you can't even get, you know, Rot House or whatever it was.
Yeah.
But now it's definitely expanded quite a bit, which is helpful. They're all very different, but I think that that's why they work in each space. You know, when you think about Boston, we've been there for so long. We've become a part of that neighborhood that it feels very, it feels safe. People ask a lot, like, how is it that you can carry such different things and not feel obligated to carry, you know, the most standard
20 IPAs.
20 IPAs or whatever it may be. And I think that, you know, we've come to have this reputation of having not those things. People now expect something different. They don't expect to have, you know, 20 IPAs on the menu. They don't expect Bud Light to be there, all of that. So, you know, that feels, you know, safe. Burlington is very different. It's the suburbs, you know, we're right next to a steakhouse and a couple office buildings. So the vibe is very different. But what's really great about that is that there's really not another restaurant that's similar to ours in that area. And, you know, the biggest program next to ours for beer is, I think there's like a tavern in the square next to it. I don't know if you're familiar with mm-hmm. that.
Yeah.
It's kind of like I guess you could compare it to a Yard House, but a very like large draft list, but, you know, lots of things that you could expect. So while they have a beer program there, it's very different than the one in Burlington. And then Portsmouth is like on an island of its own, of course. And like that area is just so unique and fun and like very much like vacation-y. So like that vibe is also very different, but there's definitely like the diehard like beer people that go there, people that are vacationing in town that want a cool, fun cocktail, people that want to crush, you know, oysters and like have a glass of wine. So it's a very like different dynamic in each space, but it's really interesting to have this sort of like common thread throughout all three. So you feel like whenever you go into each space, like you're going like, this is Row, this is it, this is where I am. But each space has their own sort of like vibe and their own sort of purpose within the area that they're in, that it feels like different enough and unique enough and fun enough that it's like, all right, this freaking works. I love it. And it's also like true that like each team is a little bit different, so it also makes for a very different vibe in each space.
Mm-hmm. As you talk about those three teams, and to relate it back to some of the questions that Noah was asking, I've always been kind of fascinated by how like good culture, education's involved in that, but really just culture standalone, good culture and growth are kind of polar opposites. So like they fly in the face of each other. It's easy to have good culture in a small team.
Yeah.
And as things get bigger and bigger and bigger, that becomes a harder equation to manage.
Sure,
We've talked about it with a number of people on here. There seems to be something about proximity that obviously matters. If you look somebody in the eyes every day and you know a lot of their personal struggles and you know where they're coming from, there's going to be a humanity and a connection there that you can't replicate.
Oh, yeah.
As you get to 70 people, 80 people, 100 people, now you talk different locations. Now you talk further geography. Can you talk at all about, I guess in the most basic sense, do you guys view the way through that almost as like, the three locations being more insular from each other, or do you really lean into having all of it be one big family? You talking about the trust of Portsmouth, I think, is what kind of got me like that. They can handle their thing, sort of thing. Just kind of opine on how you view that.
Yeah, I think it's a com- combo. I think it's, so we operate with, you know, a global team. So that's myself. I'm the global beer director, but I'm also the GM in Boston. We have a global wine director, Laura. She's based out of Burlington, and then global spirit director, and that's Van, and he's based out of Burlington as well. Each manager has the capability of going into each space and being on the floor. Operationally speaking, it's all very similar. Food, it's all very similar. The wine program differs from each space, as is the beer program, but the ethos is really all the same. So, you know, in theory, I should be able to go to any space and know what to expect on an operational sort of level. And then when you kind of hone in onto each space, what makes each space so great is that they have their own unique team. My, you know, service staff and our bartenders are different than the staff in Burlington, that are different than the staff in Portsmouth, not different in bad or good ways, but different in that they have come to fit in that space. They are a part of that space. We have regulars that come in because they want to see so-and-so behind the bar. They want to see this person as their server, so they're going to come in every Thursday. And that's true in every single space. And I think that that really is a true testament to this sort of like grand idea of, you know, hospitality, education, and team. Teamwork makes the dream work. And then that sort of just is able to sort of resonate through all three spaces in its own special way. So yes, there's this really important sort of team that we have that goes across the board. And then it's also super important to know that, you know, each individual team has their own niches and cool stuff about them that you just can't replicate in another space. But we all have the ability to work together, and we all have worked together, which I think is very unique. And I think what makes it pretty freaking cool. If I do say so.
There's a lot of pretty freaking cool. Always a good sign. Going back to the beer, like, menu that really I would, you know, a calling card, I wouldn't say, but it seems like you take a tremendous amount of pride in, as I think anyone that's been in any of the restaurants would agree with, as you should. I'm curious, A, how you kind of look at that, whether it's more in like a pie chart sort of way, like, all right, we got 30% will be lagers, or if you look at it more, how much food kind of plays a focus in that, or nothing at all. And then as the second part, kind of how that changes amongst the locations, because I'm sure there's sort of micro trends, you know, within each of those cities.
Yeah. So the way that I look at, you know, the list is there should be a bit of an equal portion of things. So, you know, in Boston, it's 3 or 4 lagers, 3 or 4 saisons, you know, 5 IPAs, a cider line, 5 sour ales. And then depending on the season, you know, you can go heavier or lighter on, you know, your stouts and so on and so forth. That's really sort of like the general formula for it all. And then to also have a healthy combination of, you know, your imported stuff. So a nice like chunk of German beer, nice chunk of Belgian, or Australian or Brazilian or whatever it is, and to have a nice healthy mix of that. It shouldn't be all beers from Massachusetts. It shouldn't be all beers from New Hampshire. It shouldn't be, you know, just everything from New England. It should be a healthy sort of combination of all those things. That's like my general philosophy. Like I mentioned before, Boston, I can experiment a lot more because I think that people have come to know that that's what they can expect there. With Burlington, the list is more heavy on like the package side. In Boston, we have 24 draft lines. Burlington, we have 16. So it's not quite as like heavy on like the sours, but still fairly heavy on your like lagers and farmhouse styles. Just because that's what I'm really passionate about. So I like to put those things in there. And then Portsmouth, because of, again, this sort of issue with getting product there, it's very heavily New Hampshire focused, but again, with a nice healthy mix of Belgian and German influence. And then obviously some Massachusetts, New England things that we can get there now, which has been good. But there's like a general formula and then just kind of honing it into each space. And then also like there's some staff that are super excited about certain breweries. So trying to take that into account too, their opinion matters. So someone's really stoked on, you know, something from main beer company, we're going to do it, or, you know, whatever it may be.
How much value do you put on being, you know, you're especially in Boston would be, there's just buying power in terms of behind the name and in terms of just on the brewery side. I mean, for us, for instance, it was the first place we ever had beer in Massachusetts, Row 34. So yeah. Certainly for me, how much value do you put on it seems like kind of the apex of the industry valuing being the one that got the thing.
Yeah,
the one that had the keg. But that was a big thing. And I mean, in Portland, frankly, it would always be Navarre, whether they were angling for that or not. I mean, if you can, who wouldn't want the one keg?
Right.
But it just seemed like it created far more negative just reactions and feelings in general over time of just resentment, other bars resentment, especially in a place like Portland that is so close knit. Mm-hmm. It's like throwing resentment every way, basically, if you weren't the one that got the keg. So I'm going off track a little bit there though, but how much has that played into sort of the development and of Road 34?
Necessarily say I go for something just because I'm the only one that gets it. I have to be excited about it. I mean, I was excited when you guys wanted to do something at Row. That made me feel like I was doing my job and that you guys felt safe and that you guys felt like you wanted to be there and the vibe was good for you. And so that to me is what that says. When someone reaches out and says, I have the only one, do you want it? And if it's a symbiotic relationship and I feel like, oh my God, like, I freaking love you. Of course I like want that. Like, I'm not just going to say yes to something because it's the popular thing to do. I have to, you know, feel like it's something that benefits the program. It benefits the restaurant and it benefits, you know, the brewery itself. I'm not just going to say yes to say yes. Is it really freaking cool for, you know, someone to reach out and be like, I want you to pour my beer? It absolutely is. But it's
really freaking cool.
It's really freaking cool. I've said that a lot, but here we are.
I love it. I love it. It's extremely Midwest.
I'm an excitement person and I get into it. But let me kind of even expounding on that. I say a stupid thing that I've fallen in love with over the few years up here that I found to be magic. And it seems like you very much kind of subscribe to the same thing. And it's like sharing over selling.
Yeah.
Like when I'm truly excited about something and I share that excitement with you, there's a connection and there's a place we can hit as like as your server and a customer that you can't really get almost anywhere else in the experience, no matter what you were doing.
Yes.
When my excitement matches your excitement, that's the apex of service experience.
Yes.
And we talk about that a lot at the brewery, but we're also a very small team in a very small place, right?
Yeah.
So I found, as I've started to think about like my future and getting older and just future in general, like all this kind of basis, my strength has been individual connection.
Yeah.
That's my strength in my operating system. I tend to be able to connect with people well. I'm not feigning excitement. It's real. So I operate on like an individual basis.
Yeah.
That works in a place like Milo, where there's 1,800 people and it's small. I've started recently, and I don't know why, but really thinking about that sort of thing in big cities, mm-hmm. right? Like Row 34 in Boston probably can't be built on like, our servers are going to connect with every individual person. You know what I mean? I don't know what percentage of your customers are regulars, and that'd be interesting for you to kind of break down the customer base. But how do you kind of teach, train, and view customer connection at a place that's very big and you may only be seeing these people once and things like that? Because you seem to be as excited about it as I am.
I am. We originally had this sort of like saying of treat your neighbors like celebrities and celebrities like neighbors. Someone said that to me when I first started working there, and I was like, well, that's interesting. And like, it's actually The concept is really, really great. Like, it's
because I think both sides want that.
Both yeah,
sides like, want that. Yeah. No, I like that.
But it's just like, even the way that I like to think about it is when you go out, what do you want, like, out of an experience? What do you want to take away from it? When someone is unkind to you and dismissive, or when, you know, a server's in the corner on their phone, how does that make you feel? Like, it doesn't uh-huh. make you feel good, usually. So when people are coming in, it's like they're coming into our house. How do you want someone to feel that's coming into your space? Do you want them to feel this way or that way? Does that formula work for every person? It sure doesn't. There are some people that want to come in, have a beer, leave, get out, don't talk to me. Then there are mm-hmm. some people that want to be doted on, that want to celebrate, that want to know all the things that you know and want to take the time to talk to you. And I think the important thing is to lean in to whatever it is that you're vibing with. If someone's vibing with you and you want to, like, dive into it, dive into it. Be generous. If someone wants to, you know, not have that type of experience, that's fine too. Everyone has their own vibe. And whether it's someone's first and last time there or whether it's their 200th time, the important thing for me is that they're taking away something good, that they're taking away that they had a really great, you know, oyster experience, that they had a beer that they never had before, that their server did something really nice for them. They did a cool pairing with dessert, or they were drinking red wine with their oysters and someone splashed them with white. There's a sort of, like, level of hospitality and care that you can extend to someone, but without it feeling like too much or too mm-hmm. little. And I think it's always about just sort of, like, reading the guests and what type of experience it is that they want.
Kind of the recognition of it and trying to deliver that. Is that something you guys talk about a lot and teach?
It is, but that's tough to teach, you know? Yeah. Like, you kind of, it's kind of like someone's personality or their work ethic. They have to, like, really have it. And it can definitely be sort of absorbed over time, but there's just, I think there's some people that have this sort of ability to have a conversation and to be excited about something. There's some people that are really great at being, like, methodical at their job. Their service points are super, you know, on point, but maybe they're not as open as far as conversational. Some people are more energetic. I'm, like, very enthusiastic about things. Some people may not be as, like, outwardly enthusiastic, but may sort of, like, have that, you know, held tight. But I think that that's also, like, that's part of the experience. If you're going to get this server one time and this server the next, like, I think that it's important to have that sort of dynamic of everyone being different, but also being able to deliver an experience that's appropriate.
Yeah. Wait, just as a funny, I'm certainly as excited and visibly enthusiastic as you most times.
Not as good as articulating it, maybe.
Not very bad at articulating. A lot of stuttering. Owls hate it. I learned that yesterday. Owls hate stuttering. But and then the girl who works with me, who was we were kind of the first two there right from open, also not huge personality, but very much loves to connect and very good at connecting. Then we brought in a third who's kind of as big and loud as me. And our most recent hire is about one of the quieter people you're ever going to meet in your entire life, because that is necessary. And not every customer is looking for that huge, enthusiastic experience. And it's been cool to kind of do what you're talking about. Won't, like, be super overt about it in service, but we'll kind of try to manage the flow quietly of, like,
play the matchup.
Yeah, letting like, oh, that's a Dustin customer. That's a Justin. That's a Brit customer. And kind of letting the right person fall at the table, sort of thing. Has been fun to watch happen.
I wanted to ask, as much or as little as you want to talk about it, I said it earlier, you would easily convince me that you own Row 34 in terms of just that genuine. And I mean that only as the highest compliment for someone representing a business. That's literally the penultimate thing.
Ownership mentality.
Do you want to take that to the next level? This is not a proposal. This is not Shark Tank. It sounded like very much a proposal, and it's not. Because I can help you take it to the next tier. But I asked because, like, you know, having owned this business for 8, 9 years, whatever it's been, I envy the other side now so much. Like the place where you could have autonomy, like a good amount of autonomy, yeah. But at the end of the day, there's a pretty clear line where you can, and of course the more higher up of a manager you are, the more that line blurs.
Yeah. Yeah.
But you at least have the ability to make that line for yourself if you want to.
Yeah.
That almost seems like the perfect thing, but as always, the grass is
greener.
So I'm wondering, what kind of thoughts you have on that long term?
Long term. For now, I think I still really want to hone in my skills of, you know, being in three places and sort of embracing this global beer director position. And I really felt like, you know, I feel like a lot of people say this, but going into 2020, I really was setting the programs up to be, you know, something that I felt like very proud of. We had Swansea Day in 2019. Mm-hmm. So I was really feeling like I was in a good spot to keep really sort of growing and moving forward and doing field trips and collaborations and like getting us out of just like the restaurant space. So I think that I would love to continue on that mission, but I won't say never when it comes to sort of owning my own space. But I also know very well the sort of trials and tribulations that one goes through when they own something. My husband owns this company called Modern Draft.
Yeah, of course. Right.
Oh. I almost assume that people know.
They've done work for us. And yeah, it's amazing. I forgot about that because he used to work with you at Row, right?
He did. Yeah, that's how we met. And then he and his partner started, you know, Modern Draft couple years into that. So I would know very well how tough it is to own your own thing. And, you know, you're never off the clock. And, you know, I'm sure you don't get a day off. You're always on call. There's always, you know, someone that you have to answer to. And there's nothing wrong with it. But I'm not sure if that's something I'm ready for now. But again, mm-hmm. Never say never. I've definitely thought about owning my own, you know, little bar space, something that could be fun and with a relatively like manageable list with, you know, cool bites. But in the near future, I don't think so. But in the far future, who knows?
Cool.
Yeah.
Question just on the future. global. I got to talk about that word.
Talk about it.
Is there... was that it seems chosen intentionally almost like because global when you're talking about only a portion of New England, you know, versus the globe. Yeah. I wonder if, yeah, kind of what in terms of Row 34 specifically plans of growth are.
I definitely think that there are plans to expand when that will be. I'm not sure. But as far as like the global aspect of it, the intention behind it was really to just sort of highlight the fact that like on like an upper level, we're all sort of involved and we're able to be in each space. And that I think that, you know, I'm where I'm at because I've worked really hard to be there and that, you know, my skill set is valuable. So here I am in these three spaces and the same could be said for the other global employees. And the reason for that is that there's just this sort of like tie between the three at the upper level. And then like it all sort of trickles down from there. But as far as like expansion goes, I'm not sure when or where, but, I'm global, so I'm here for it.
Yeah, you're ready to go. Yeah. Well, that's awesome. Unless you guys have anything
else. I've got one more, and then we end it with a quick little segment that is not too bad, and we'll have you out of here right on schedule. But I did, and everything listening to you to get ready to this, and I think I've said it in this pod 20 times, definitely kind of just resonated or found your vibe familiar to my own. And the thing you said about your ability to learn, the confidence in your ability to learn, has really been something that's kind of sat with me and that I want to think more about. Sure. We've talked
on here quite a bit with some other people, and it's something I've been quite open about, but things like imposter syndrome
or kind of those sorts of things.
Things, imposter syndrome adjacent things, things like that. But I did just kind of want to ask you, frankly, if you, there's a sense of humility to you, but there's also an incredible sense of confidence that, that seemed to be rocking side by side that I find interesting. And I think the mistake I always make in my head is that I relate one to the other, that almost like if my belief that I can do this or should do this is almost related to an arrogance or a confidence that I shouldn't have. There's like this weird disconnect that I'm always playing these gymnastics to try to figure out how to get over, because deep down, I don't have a lack of faith in my ability.
Right.
I don't think. I have the confidence that I'm going to be able to learn. And I like that phrase because it almost makes me feel like I can be fearless in doing anything without that feeling cocky or arrogant or any of those bad words. So just a little bit, if you could talk about if you have ever struggled with that, if you still, if you deal with kind of those thoughts of questioning yourself or things like that, and where you live in that space as you lead a number of people in three different locations, how do you sit with that at night?
I mean, it's a big question to answer, but I think...
Very big question. I apologize.
No, please don't. I love that. I think it's a combination of things. I think that my ability to learn and my knowing that I can continue to learn, I think that when you talk about someone that's cocky or someone that's, it's not even a confidence thing, it's a cockiness thing, you know, that to me says, I've stopped learning and I am the best. I am the top and you are beneath me. For me, I know that I can always learn from someone else. I am not the best and I can continue to become my best, but there's never going to be a point where I am like a pinnacle. You should always be learning. And if you're at a point where you feel like I'm the shit and like I don't have any more to give, then maybe you should rethink about where you are. Or maybe you have reached the pinnacle and perhaps there's something else that you should be doing. But for me, I always feel like there's more to know, there's room to grow, and there's more to be done. That said, there's definitely times where I feel like, how did I get here? How did I deserve this? How am I on this podcast? How, like, do people care? Like,
But
there's definitely times where I'm like, do people even care? Like, it's just beer. It's just the industry. It's just this little portion of the world that, like, does it even matter? But it does, because it matters to you. It matters to Noah. It matters to me. So I think that, like, you know, you can ebb and flow out of this sort of confidence level and say, you know, how do I deserve this? But if you know that you've, like, worked really hard to be where you are and that you are doing the best that you can, to me, that's like that's a big part of it. And you should relish in the fact that you've worked hard. And I sometimes do struggle with that. But I think that as long as you feel like you're not stuck and you're always learning, that you will allow yourself to continue to grow and to continue to learn.
I love the always learning thing. I think mine is rooted in letting people down. So it's not like I don't think I've done what I've done.
I see.
It's like I make this decision and it is wrong and we really fuck up. That's where I feel bad, or, you know, where some of that gets hung up. But that's why that learning thing is so powerful. It's like, if this goes wrong, sorry, go ahead.
No, but that's important too. Like, when you mess up and you make a choice that maybe didn't work out, like, as long as you learn from it, then that's a part of it. But if you're the type of person that's like, oh, I made a wrong choice, but no problem, you know, whatever, then that, like, starts to it's like part of that cockiness bubble of like, it doesn't matter what I do, I'm still fine. But if you learn from something, you're like, you know what, I messed up, I should probably not do that again, then that's like part of your growth. Like,
yes, it's normal. Like, those errors, those mistakes are part of the process of being better.
Yeah.
Sort of thing.
Yeah. It's learning. We're all human.
Hoorah.
Yeah, we're all human. But it is interesting to just, like, as a final thing on that, it's like, so many people are on the black and white side of these polls of, like, you're constantly trying to, they're doubt, like the mountain of what they don't know seems too high to even begin to climb. So they're kind of in this perpetual Eeyore-ness of like, well, this is just my lot in life. Yeah. Like, this is me. Like, no, I'm not doing that. Or the other side, and we all know so many of them, which are some version of the like, yeah, I'm up at the top of this mountain. It's kind of fucking sucks up here. But so many of people, it's like this constant being tugged back and forth of like, you need enough confidence to keep going.
Yeah.
But perpetually, like, there's these weird ass head games with self-confidence that it's just a very, it's an, the best people I know all have a very delicate balance of it that I just kind of love thinking about. But as always, very strong ending from me. But I want to bring it back to the beginning of what we talked about a little bit. Matt can set me up and give you.
I'm only going to set you up because I'm afraid to try to pronounce at least one of these.
Oh, no.
So we do a little thing at the end of all of these. We call the three bay. After a serious discussion or kind of going deep on some topics, we end with a very fun, easy, loose segment where I'm going to give you, well, Noah's going to give you, because he can pronounce them. Noah's going to give you three beers.
Oh, no.
You are going to take it back to the beginning, and we're going to imagine the alternative universe somewhere where you are still a marine biologist.
Yes.
And you are going to pick three marine mammals, and you are going to pair them up with the three beers that Noah gives you, and you're going to tell us why you're pairing those up.
Oh,
nice
okay.
Little free association game.
I love a free association task.
What have we got for beers, Noah?
I free associated beers I associate with you. I know two of them for sure. The third one, I'm not sure what you think about it. But first, Rothaus Pils, already mentioned. You're the only place I've ever heard of that has it constantly on. And just a beer I love, a beer I've foisted on Matt many times. Special place in my heart for that brewery. So Rothaus Pils is one, a brewery that is maybe 3-4 hours away from that. The Andex Monastery, we'll go Andex Doppelbach.
Okay.
You seem like you'd be a fan of that beer, maybe.
Sure I am.
Okay, right on. And then last but not least, it was something I also found super interesting. At kind of a similar story to how Matt's Bukowski's thing was about sort of... almost like your ghost was in the room kind of without knowing it.
Yeah.
The last time I was there, maybe, I mean, hell, you might've even been the server. I really don't remember. But I went in there before a show with some friends and I had never had Tank 7. Boulevard's not distributed to Maine. So when I would go to Mass, oftentimes it'd be breweries like that I'd be most excited about, like regional breweries that just didn't send beer to Maine.
Yes.
And I drank like 4 or 5 Tank 7.
Oh my
I knew
God.
The deal. Huh?
Were you done?
It's that good. Yeah. Oh, it's so easy. And it was just like whoever was serving was like commented verbatim, like, man, you really like Tank 7, huh? And I was like, I guess I do. Tank 7, Boulevard Tank 7 as the last one. So 2 Germans, 1 American Belgian.
Yeah.
Okay.
And you're going to give us 3 marine mammals to pair with them.
3 marine mammals. Okay, so Tank 7, I love. It's high in alcohol. It's spicy. It's like warming. I'm probably going to say an Orca for a Tank 7 because Orcas, they're spicy. They're sassy. They're like, you know, I just feel it. I feel it.
I like it.
Yeah.
And orcas are definitely spicy.
They're spicy. Yeah.
When you keep them in captivity for especially a long time, they definitely are.
Especially if you're a smaller fish.
Yeah, that's a whole other conversation.
I apologize.
I would say Rothaus, clean, classic, hang out anytime. I would say Atlantic Bottlenose Dolphin, super smart. Mm. They're like, I feel like, you know, when people think about marine mammals, like your first thing was a dolphin. So like, I think that, you know, for Rothaus, that feels like pretty right. I'm the guy. I feel like the Doppelbach is definitely a little bit harder, but I'm going to say a California Sea Lion.
Visual work.
Yeah. But you know, like, fire. It's like not like super mainstream, but just mainstream enough. And like, kind of fun, and you know, I would say California Sea Lion for the dog.
Man,
hoorah!
That was so fast.
Quick and easy.
That was, you murdered
We've
that.
Had people like pause it, be like, I'll be back in 20 minutes. Let me think about this. I got to write some things biology. Down.
Maybe that it was a amazing. Mistake to get out of it. Or maybe you need to find how to combine them because, I mean, you know, you combined them pretty damn well there.
There's a well, there's a way. So I'm going to do it. We're going to figure it out.
Absolutely. But Susie Hayes, thank you so much for the time. Maybe next time we'll be able to do it in person, but...
You're
enough
a close neighbor, and we will be able to do this in person sometime. And after this conversation, I really look forward to that because this was a blast. I really appreciate you taking the time.
Yeah, you guys are awesome. Thank you for having me again. This was really fun.
Absolutely. Amazing. Literally anytime, anytime. But yeah, hope to see you soon in person. Things usually go a little smoother there.
Awesome. Yeah, I'm in the mood. Slow and careful, my body's ready for a mountain climb. All of a sudden it will all become lovely, the flower that opens.